I met our next guest in 1988 when he was spearheading the reenactment of the First Fleet in time for, yes, the bicentennial celebrations. He's also entrepreneured a reenactment of Matthew Flinders' circumnavigation of Terra Australis, William Bligh's fated journey on the Bounty, and even followed in the steps of Shackleton's trip to the Antarctic. His latest book is an autobiography called Tall Ships, Tall Tales, A Life of Dancing with History, and he's in the Sydney studio. Welcome, Jonathan. It's been a long time since we've talked.
Great to hear your voice, Philip, and thanks for having us on your legendary show.
You've had some great history teachers across the panorama, haven't you? Manning Clark to the left, Geoffrey Blaney to the right. What gave you the idea of reenacting the journey of the First Fleet? Was it them or that trip to Russia in 71? Or the fact that one of your ancestors sailed in the First Fleet?
Well, a combination, Philip. And like my host, I was a young communist and I went to the Soviet Union for enlightenment. And it didn't take long, once I got behind the Iron Curtain, to decide that communism wasn't the answer and I couldn't wait to get out. And I was sent there by another young lefty at the time called Rupert Murdoch, who just started up the Australian newspaper and authorised my trip, despite Walter Comer, the then editor, as you'll remember, being a long-time writer for The Australian, telling me I couldn't go because I'd have to leave the shipping round. And as a cadet journalist, that was my first duty. But anyway, that was a bit of an inspiration. But yeah, it was the governor, because my wife Jane and I went down to see his grave in the back blocks of London somewhere and read his tombstone and got inspired, because I'd never heard of the story of the First Fleet or anything like that. And I said, hey, let's do it.
Thor Heyerdahl also gave you a thrill, didn't he, as he did me?
Well, we're that generation who were reading Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki expedition in the early 50s, and it was following those bleak war years, and it just shone such a wonderful white ray of light white hope across the world. And I just dreamed one day that I might do something like the Kon-Tiki expedition, and down the track, Thor Heyerdahl, when I met him in the Kon-Tiki Museum in Oslo, agreed to become the president of the First Fleet reenactment expedition on the condition, Philip, that we had the United Nations flag, international crews, and carried out surveys for the environment.
Jonathan, I remember you having your financial challenges and also your irritations with, in fact, us, the Australian public, because you saw the achievement of the 11 ships and over 1,000 people of the First Fleet as surpassing that of 100 pilgrims on board the Mayflower. And while the Americans take immense pride in that voyage, Australians at the time weren't that excited.
Well, actually, in the early 80s, it was still a little bit embarrassing to be a convict descendant. But we just reckoned that it was, objectively speaking, a fantastic achievement of Philip and the 11 ships of the First Fleet, carrying 759 convicts across the world, much bigger than the little old Mayflower, which set out with the Speedwell, and the Speedwell had to turn back through industrial problems because some of the sailors punched a hole in the hull. It's not very well publicised in America, but they started with two ships and they only made it with one. But all of our 11 made it. And I thought, what a great story. Got to tell my fellow Australians. I had the blood in me from dear old Governor King. And so that was the inspiration from day one.
Tell us about that legendary tall ship sailor, Captain Alan Villiers, who I remember with respect and affection. He sailed a Mayflower replica, didn't he, from England to America?
And many other reenactments beside, including the Mayflower. And, of course, he recreated the Joseph Conrad, tossed the engine overboard and sailed around on a square rigger with a crew in the 1930s. But he was like no other man I've ever met. When I rang him up and said, look, I'm in London. I want to come up and see you in Oxford. Maybe you could help me. He said, who the hell are you? I said, I'm Jonathan King. He said, so? I said, well, my ancestor was on the First Fleet. He said, so? He's not going to be any help to you. He's dead. What square rig ships have you sailed on, son? Anyway, I sort of made it through that storm, got to see him, and then he became our first patron. And he said, all you got to do, young fella, is look out for the bureaucrats and toss out their bull lines, because they'll try and stop you the way they stopped my 1970 Endeavour reenactment when I was going to come out and do Captain Cook's voyage all over again, but the red tape sucked.
Well, it was prescient advice, because something like that pretty well happened. You registered the idea of the reenactment in 1977. You put $35 down on that, and you had, surprisingly, the support of some very influential Indigenous leaders like Charlie Perkins. Why was Charlie a supporter?
Well, the ABA, the Australian Bicentennial Authority, which didn't actually have Indigenous representation on their committee at the time, criticised us for putting an expedition together that was going to upset the Aborigines. So I contacted Charlie and he said, listen, listen, son. He said, you guys, you white fellas, you've got to have your own dream time, or you just won't know where you've come from and you won't know where you're going to. So keep your dream time, white fella.
Well, stirring advice, but unfortunately, the government fired a few shots across your bow because they launched their own tall ships venture. What was the politics of that?
Well, they just pinched that from the 1976 American Opsail Tall Ship Parade, which was put together by a young journalist called Frank Brainard, a visionary like the two fellows you just had in the studio here. And they just thought, let's pick it up, lock, stock and barrel, and put it into Australia for Australia's 200th birthday, because we don't want to know, the bureaucracy said, about the British imperialistic origins of Australia. We want to cut our ties with the past. We want to phase out that whole convict heritage thing. We're going to rewrite Australian history, embrace Southeast Asia, and we don't want King's First Fleet to remind people about this politically incorrect historical beginning for the nation.
I've just realised I'm going to say something absolutely appalling. You nonetheless got up a head of steam for your sail ships, didn't you?
It's only about 100 years out of date, Philip.
Yeah, forgive me. By 1984, you still didn't have the 11 ships or sailors, but increasingly you got the public behind you. Was it people paying their passage on board or sponsorship which funded you?
Well, basically, there were 1 million descendants of those First Fleet convicts. They didn't want the bureaucracy to sweep their proud heritage under the carpet. So our very first donation was from a fellow called Ian Palmer from Palmer Sports Stores, who was a convict descendant. He gave me $500 when a mate of mine, Peter Blasey, and I launched the project.
Peter, of course, worked for Moss Cass, one of the more interesting Whitlam ministers.
That's right. And he shared the job with my publisher, Henry Rosenblum, from Scribe.
Who hardly a program passes without one of Scribe's books squeaking into it.
Yeah, they really are serious books worth reading. But anyway, back to this yarn for a moment. The whole problem with the bureaucracy was that they just wanted to have the tall ships. They didn't want to have this historical reenactment because they thought we were turning the clock back. But in fact, not only the 1 million descendants of the convicts, but millions of other Australians said, wait a minute, this is our mainstream heritage. And these blokes with their First Fleet, they're working with Charlie, they're working with Burnham, they're working with Pat O'Shane, they're talking to Reginald Blowies on the committee, they're actually going to fly Aboriginal flags, they're going to put a Macarata in the Sydney Morning Herald, and we were on their side. So instead of drawing a veil over the invasion, we're actually saying it happened, and that pleased people like Burnham.
I also recall that there was chaos in and around the Bicentennial Authority, all sorts of incredible fights. And as I recall, Hawke sacked John Reed, who was the chairman. John, of course, later became CEO at James Hardie of asbestos fame.
Well, you're quite right. You've got a memory like one of those things with a big trunk. I can't remember what they're called, but he was already the chairman of James Hardie Asbestos, John Reed. So he was used to batting balls bowled his way by people like Matt Peacock. And that whole asbestos thing was growing momentum. But he was very strong hand at the helm of the Bicentennial Authority. And it was when he sacked his general manager, David Armstrong, Dr. David Armstrong, that people started to smell a rat, and Hawke started to look into it, and he realised that Reed had given Armstrong $504,000 as a golden handshake, and that was actually $4,000 more than the whole of the bureaucracy lent us for our entire First Fleet project. And Hawke said, "This doesn't smell right." And he had a good yarn to Reed, and then he gave him the Khyber.
Coming back to the question I asked you, was it a big help when people were willing to pay their passage on board?
I'm sorry I didn't answer that from before. That's what did it. Although the bicentennial bureaucracy wouldn't endorse our project, we got into bed with people like Australian Himalayan Expeditions, and they said, "We don't care about endorsement. We're going to sell passengers on these ships, even if you haven't locked them down." And they started selling passages. And we had people paying $13,000. I went around the world on a few speaking tours, and before long we had hundreds of people paying a full voyage of $13,000.
A lot of money in 88.
My word. And that's what made it viable. And then a fellow called Michael Edgley stepped forward. He said, "I'll give you a hand." And he decided to become the impresario that would produce the greatest show on water. Still the bureaucracy dug in and said, "No, we won't endorse this outrageous project." Edgley wouldn't have a clue, et cetera, et cetera. And it became a battle royal, which is the story of this Tall Ships and Tall Tales book.
I'm going to throw a curly one at you. I can't resist.
I knew you would.
I want you to reassure me that you didn't go ahead with Helen Reddy's suggestion to have a regression session with a psychic in order to get in touch with yours and her ancestors, who were apparently quite good friends.
Well, just talking off air for a moment with you now, Philip, I've got to tell you that she is so persuasive, such a lovely woman, and I did. I had a terrific regression session, and she put me back in touch with, she was meant to put me back in touch with my ancestors, but I ended up getting in touch with Governor Philip. We got the names wrong.
You're naughty, aren't you?
Just exploratory like you.
We should mention that Helen's making a return to the stage, and she'll be coming back to Australia very shortly to sing out loud. Okay.
But it was people like her and people like a young Philip Adams working for Monaghan, Damon and Adams as a partner, and then Mojo, that actually gave us the commercial oomph to get us going and beat the bureaucracy.
I'd entirely forgotten that.
Mate, they were the best advertisements we ever had.
Okay. Now, I reckon at the moment there are so many reenactments and expeditions to go here and there that the head whirls. Are we overdoing it a bit now?
Well, given that history, particularly Australian history, is not very well taught in the schools, mavericks like me have to take to the tall ships on the high seas to teach the history that is omitted from the schools.
I'm not so much talking about Australian reenactments. They're all over the world, aren't they? There's, reenactments of Joseph and Mary's journey into Bethlehem and and your attempt, of course, to follow Marco Polo's return trip to Venice.
Until it was sabotaged by real-life pirates. But look, Philip, it depends. If you want to have some uplifting stories about the great achievements of some of our historical leaders in the past, then I think it's worth telling the story through reenactments. And it's better than sitting in front of the TV as a couch potato.
We've been discussing the southern polar regions a lot lately for one or another reason. In 2003, you followed Shackleton's footsteps. Briefly, and we've only got a couple of minutes, tell us about that. Were you prayed the ship's windows were thick enough to withstand the sea?
Well, I was terrified because although I was under the leadership of the great Mr. Modesty, Greg Mortimer, our first Australian up Everest, we were hit by storms that he hadn't seen for years. And we went to Elephant Island, where, of course, Shackleton had left the men and done the 16-day trip in the James Caird across to South Georgia. We followed that. But once we got to Gritviken, I made the mistake of climbing up on the cliff and walking towards Shackleton's grave, the great big white memorial cross that some of your listeners would have seen, when a cyclone hit and I was blown along the cliff and I was clinging to the edge when Mortimer's men came and pulled me back, really from the brink of death. So that was actually one of the
scariest. That's because those winds remove the oxygen, don't they?
Yep, exactly. And that's what Mortimer explained to me. And as I'm an asthmatic, That's the last thing you want to happen to you. So I'm not going to race back down to Antarctica just yet.
You regard Shackleton's rescue mission of all his men as a greater feat than Bligh's open voyage across the Pacific.
Yes, because Frank Wolseley only had 3 days out of 16 where he could actually see the sun. And if, as he was navigating with sextant and compass from the sun, which you need to take a noon sighting of, and he only saw it 3 times in that 16-day voyage, he had to do the whole thing by dead reckoning, gauging current, drift and what have you. I think it's absolutely phenomenal.
It's an interesting world you've created for yourself, this being an entrepreneur of large-scale historical events. If you had your druthers, what would you do for an encore?
I think I'd try and set up a show like Late Night Live.
Sorry, it's taken. No, seriously, one last hurrah, quickly.
One last hurrah. I'd quite like to go across America in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark, because I worked in America for quite a while, and that was one of the great overland expeditions. We did Burke and Wills with Jack Thompson recently. That was pretty good here in the Australian deserts. But that American first crossing was epic.
Have you ever done Lassiter?
We just don't quite know where to start looking for that reef. But if the gold's out there, Philip, I'll give you a call and we'll do it together, mate.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Jonathan King's autobiography is called Tall Ships and Tall Tales, published by the aforementioned scribe. On our next, we welcome back Bruce Shapiro, and we have a chat about Mussolini's favourite poet. Mussolini had a favourite poet, really? Now, rush out of the shops now for your USB sticky. We've got Poddies, we've got Gladdies, we've got Maddies, we've got Noddies. Who else have we got? And now we've got Stickies, or into the competition for a free one. Well, who would be your dream LNL guest and why in 25 words or less? Go to the LNL homepage and click on the links. I think I might enter that. I'd love to get Gary Wills on. I've been trying for 23 years. Stick around now for the news, and goodbye for now.